All right, good evening, everyone. As I was sitting, realized that some of you I saw this morning, we sat together, and now we sat again. And I wondered what happened in between in terms of our practice. We start the day by that, and if you didn't sit, maybe you sat on your own, or you didn't sit, but you did something else. And I was wondering how do we bring our practice? How do we extend our practice in all our other activities? And when do we feel that it doesn't go very well? That, or our practice trains us to notice that something is off. And as I was sitting just now, a sutra came up, the sutra that talks about when Shakyamuni had his realization, and after a while he kind of stepped down and went into the marketplace and tried to communicate his understanding and totally failed. The first guy he meets, he's basically he tries to interact with him and tell him about the wisdom he has discovered, and basically the guy says, "Well, good for you, man." And he just continues his way. Doesn't work. And then second encountering, same thing happens, and meet his friends and they don't really, whatever. I feel very much like that right now. Going into the marketplace and with that desire to share, and sometimes it's just doesn't work at all. But it's very interesting also. I was warned actually by one of Maizumi's successor. I'm very close to her, Nikuli McMahon Roshi, and she said to me, "Well, you'll grow. You will start as an immature sensei and grow into a mature sensei, then move into an immature Roshi and turn into a mature Roshi." And I feel very much like an immature sensei. And three encounterings, took place recently that were very telling for me of various aspects of the practice. And I thought I would share that with you. Maybe that might make sense. And the first encountering is during the transmission week. A friend of mine who came and showed were present at the ceremony, at the coming out ceremony, where who was present at the show, and so he saw the whole thing unfolding. And then he said, then we had a chat afterwards, and he said, "So, what's all that about? And what's the superiority of Buddhism compared to other traditions? Why this one and not another one? Why this wisdom and compared to another wisdom? Why do you choose this and not something else?" A legitimate question, What's the meaning of it all? What's the meaning of that practice? It's a legitimate question, and it has been asked in many, many koans. It comes up in many koans. So that question was actually asked to me like that. And because the man is very intellectual, and he kind of asked me on an intellectual level, and I tried to answer on an intellectual level. And as I was unfolding and trying to explain things and got into details about the Four Noble Truths or the Four Tasks, and then the precepts and the meaning of the precepts, and then like arguments after arguments, and then there were counter arguments that, I was trapped. I was totally trapped. I was very unsatisfied, and afterwards I just left, actually. I thought, this is, I'm not answering his question, and I'm answering his question in such poor way. And I've been reflecting on that since then. So I've been reflecting on that interaction for a month now. And after a while, I realized that he was asking me questions, and the strange thing is that he witnessed the whole ceremony. He witnessed the show. He witnessed what we did. He witnessed what was said. And yet, that wasn't sufficient. And I was trying to give him more items to think about. It was right in front of his eyes, and he just didn't see it. And it struck me so much, after the show, what I said, it's like what was manifested, what everyone manifested was that authenticity, that presence, that joy. I mean, actually, you could probably name all the paramitas, the joy, and that was all there. That was just all there. And he didn't see it, and then I was trying to explaining. I was trying to explain, to give more intellectual explanation about it, and of course that failed. So afterwards, I've kept thinking afterwards. What should have I said? What would have been more appropriate for him to have a glimpse about the answer to his question? And it was probably, something around shifting the conversation to what have you felt there, probably would have been a much more appropriate answer. What did you feel when you saw that? What did you witness? Tell me what you witnessed. And there's something in there about the experience, the actual experience versus the intellectual understanding of it all, the dualistic understanding. And I say that being very much versed, as you know, in concepts and in the philosophy of Buddhism and all that, and we can get trapped into that, and not seeing the core of the experience, of what is being experienced when we walk on that path. the second recent encountering, was last weekend at a party, at a dinner party. And I saw someone that I have known for a long time, friend of a friend, and who has tons of opinions, tons of opinions. And everything seemed so closed, so. As if nothing could actually penetrate. And I thought my desire to help or make her understand something, just I was trying to create a breach in there, create a slight breach, a crack, so that the light can come in, as Donat Cohen says. And the more I was trying, the more I could feel her resistance, the more I could feel my frustration, and the more I could feel that I was becoming more and more radical and more upset about, and more provocative also. And I saw it very quickly. I mean, I saw my dissatisfaction and my frustration. And later on, I reflected upon that the vow that we sing, the first vow. Sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. And we have had, all of us, I think, endless discussions together or with ourselves about what the hell is saving? Why do we use saving? Or I'm uncomfortable with the word saving and all that. And could we replace it with something else? And what does that mean? And I think I was, at that moment, in that interaction, I wanted to save her in a way. I wanted to, create a breach, create a crack, create something, a little space for her to understand something. And she was also, she's super skinny and she's so tensed and she's so, she doesn't say she's unhappy, but it's like, wow. Not at peace, definitely not at peace. And I wanted to provide something. And me wanting to provide something made me frustrated because there was no achievement in there. I didn't achieve anything. And then I was reflecting, what was that about? My desire to just create a crack. And this week I thought about this story that I think told Roshi about the Dalai Lama in an interview one day, and some people were just telling stuff about Buddhism, and he didn't say anything. Just didn't respond. Actually, this woman started with me about mindfulness and meditation and started to give me all her opinions about mindfulness and meditation and all that. Now that she was not asking me any questions. And it was difficult for me not to answer. There was no question. So in what she was actually telling. So why should I answer? So So that wasn't very successful either. And then I met with a friend this week. And she's in real pain for some personal reasons. And it was very much linked to a fear. And I said, what's the, she doesn't sleep well, and she said, like, I'm scared. I said, what's your biggest fear? And she told me, and it was very much linked to an opinion that she was actually holding, and something about the organization with her kid and the father of the kid that she separated from, and she was fearing that her wish wouldn't be fulfilled. She was fearing that so much. And it struck me, and I noticed how I told her how I it was very clear to me that what she was saying is that actually her fear was linked to something. It was the amount of the fear was correlated with her attachment to a position. So her discomfort was correlated with the degree of attachment that she had about something that maybe is very legitimate, I don't know. Or maybe it's not. But the point is that it's correlated. I didn't know what to do with that, except noticing, and I can notice that for myself, the correlation between dissatisfaction that, or the fear that is being correlated to attachment to certain ideas. And what do we do when we feel that it's fully, we are fully, fully right in thinking what we think? How do we create a little bit of space in there? And by creating a little bit of space, also maybe creating a little bit of peacefulness. So I feel I'm trying to walking this life, having encounterings, and not very productive, very helpful. But I guess I guess the continuing practice helps me notice how things unfold for me also, the reactions that are created by these interactions, my attachments, my desire to help people, or my frustration because it's not working the way I think it should work. And while I'm saying that, I should remind myself at all times what one of the precious teachings I received from the coming out ceremony from all of you, that the from the Sangha, that the what also what we do or say It's impossible to know the impact of what we do or say. And it can take a long time before something that was said a long time ago just pops up again in our head. And it's like, oh yeah, this is actually what he said to me. That's inspiring. And that maybe also it's less what we do, what we say, than how we are with people that matters the most also. We've just had at home for the past 2 weeks now. She left today, but a friend of my wife and her husband passed away on Sunday. So he was at the hospital next door, and she lives kind of far away from the hospital, so she stayed with us. And she left a note today, and she felt very supported, and she thanked us. We actually probably didn't do anything special. We didn't say anything special, but just being there. Paying attention. And yeah, the third vow, reality is boundless. Reality is boundless. I vow to see it. And as I said during the transmission week, I love the lay practice because that allows all these interactions in all kinds of environments, different environments, that allow us to see the Dharma, see reality, see how that works, and see how we can work with that. I've started teaching meditation in a business school outside Paris, and so it's a mindfulness workshop, and so I have to talk about mindfulness. And because it's within the context of a school and within the context of students and who are high achievers and who want to feel and see and recognize the benefits of spending 45 minutes with me needs to be kind of goal-oriented, which is not really how we present things usually. But that also forces me to think about this notion of mindfulness, and that the mindfulness is always mindfulness of something. And if I think about it that way, I can see all the endless, actually, spectrum of that mindfulness. Mindfulness of my breathing, mindfulness of my speech, mindfulness of my actions when I do this or when I do that, when I speak to that person and all that. And so, how do we integrate that? How do we make it alive, in everything that we do during the day? And I think this is, as lay practitioners, this is, for me, this is an inspiration. Just during the day, when are the moments when it's not happening, when the yeast is not fermenting the whatever I'm doing? That yeast of mindfulness and the sitting meditation is part of it. Is part of that activation process, but certainly not the soul activation kind of ferment. Yeah, the first task, as Stephen Batchelor says, to rephrase the first noble truth, embrace life, yeah. Embrace that reality and the totality of the existence, and see how that works out in terms of our practice, in terms of building up a space of non-reactivity, of dwelling in that non-reactivity. And it's so rich to this lay life and whatever we do during the day and work and meeting people from who don't share this practice. I mean, if we were in a monastery, the only people we would meet most of the time would be fellow practitioners. And it's much more challenging not to meet fellow practitioners and interact with these people and share our practice and for me, just being confronted to my desire to share the practice, and sometimes I feel it's not received and it's frustrating, you know. I was like, oh, the wisdom that I got from it, or that or my desire to help them to see the crack and the light through the crack. So I'm trying to actually appreciate these moments of what I see initially as failures. Really trying to appreciate that as being as being a teaching. What is happening? And for me, going back in towards to the body and see the what is actually happening in the body is a great mean to check whether things are off balance or not. Yeah, I'll stop there, and I open the floor to the discussion, questions, remarks, and feedbacks, and whatever. Yeah, Lisa.
Thank you. Actually, two things came up as you were talking. First one was your name, the one who saves. And yeah, just how do you deal with that name? Given all that you say and that you want to do, and how can you say without saving? And then the second one is, it's I told you that after during the retreat, the end of the retreat, I was so amazed how you brought all your friends and your practice and your life. I mean, because it's your life and it's the same. And it's interesting now how you say the difficulties you encounter when you try to talk about it, because in my case, it's some I never talk about my practice. Never, ever. I mean, hardly ever, except if I see someone with whom there's might be some interest. Otherwise, it's just I don't share it because I don't know what to share, and it's I wouldn't know what to explain. And as you said, it's experience. So what can you say? And I actually had a argument. The only time recently I spoke with someone that you know actually a little bit, and the person has started asking a lot of questions and challenging and why this and why that, and I was like, I don't want to answer that. I don't want to justify it. It's just that's my practice, and that's the only thing I can say. And it's difficult. It's really difficult because it's not that either you see it and you, or you don't, and it doesn't make you anything more than or less. It's just your experience of it. So, yeah, it's tricky. So when you want to. When you're in your position as a new sensei, it just, wow, what a challenge.
Yeah, thank you. It is tricky, and as I said, it's like it's this whole thing with the Buddha. His first impulse is not saying anything, and I think this is our first impulse also. This is what can you say? It's beyond words. And afterwards he just goes into the marketplace because we need to say something, and also all the stuff that we read at the end, they all say, well, these are just words, it's all about the experience, so what? And I find it is tricky, and it's tricky, and there's this thing about the skillful means, meeting people where they are, what are they really asking? And it is tricky that I feel when people are asking a question, it should be answered, but the que but also what I'm becoming more and more aware is what's their true question really? Because sometimes it appears like what they're saying is the question, but it's really kind of not. And the second encountering that I was mentioning with this girl, with everything was blocked. When she started talking about meditation, it was funny. When she did ask me questions about how I was practicing meditation, the only reason for her is that for, was to ask these questions was to verify, to check that what I was practicing was actually in conformity to her beliefs against, that she had against religion. And then I was trapped into this thing. Is like, am I? What am I doing? Then this very complicated question about, without doing a whole class about religion and the concept of religion, and we do rituals, but are rituals part of religion or not? Can rituals be not non-religious? I mean, this whole. And then at a dinner party, you don't want to have this type of conversation. So it is extremely tricky. Yeah, and extremely tricky, I feel people who ask questions deserve to have some kind of answer. What the appropriate answer is really depends on the situation, and it's we need to be skillful about it, and it's a craft that needs to be kind of learned. It's certainly my experience is recently probably out on the side of that, there were many encounters that were successful, but that I don't even see also. Because this person, this first person that I was mentioning, who came at the and who had all these questions, I mean, he witnessed something. So I don't know how what he and I haven't spoken with him since then. I don't know how it entered his body, his experience, how it interfered with his concepts. It's a challenge, and as for my name, it is also a challenge. I had that discussion with Roshi the other day, because I questioned her about what I felt as a resistance to say that she was teaching meditation. You hardly ever hear her saying that she's actually teaching. She's sharing the practice, but she's not teaching. So, and that's very, it's again, it's tricky, but I would be much more comfortable to have the name the one who serves than the one who saves. Serving seems much more understandable somehow. You're at the service of someone. Saving is already very loaded with intentions, with results, ideas about results, and oh my God, it's loaded. And maybe we save when we serve without searching for specific results. That's something I work on, I feel. Just, I share, you never know what's going to happen. You don't expect, you don't know how it the teaching find its way. Where it's going to land, how it's going to land, and you trust that. But again, with all the vows, the four vows, it's like the crucial aspect is really the intention. And this is why also the way it's formulated you can't exhaust the vows, you can't save all sentient beings, actually, because they are numberless. Can't see reality, the whole reality, because it's boundless. But we do have that intention. So there's something for me to work on with that, keeping that intention alive without being too focused on a specific result thing, and trust that path, trust that experience, and trust the it's tricky. Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
Good evening. I was thinking about the words you said about sentient beings are numberless. I tried to save them, and that I didn't really picked up as conscious as now. So I tried to save them. I will give you an example. Many years ago, I was feeling very well. I was really happy. I had a good time after a very bad time. So I saw the light. I was living my life with happiness. Then I found a man, and he was very unhappy. And he was, I had a lot of love, and I thought I can save him with my love, with my attention, with my, being there for him. But what I realized later on, in the 2 years I have met him, that I couldn't save him with all the love. And that was then hard. But I think you have something. The other person has to do you have to have the trust, I think, that the other person will find it for himself, or you know what I mean? I can't save another person.
Right.
He has to be open for it. He has to choose his own path. I can serve him. I can be with him or something, but I can't live his life. And you know what I'm trying to say here?
Yeah, I think so. There are two things I find that are worth looking into is when we want to save someone, we probably have we have an idea about what that means, what would be a satisfying result.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, I want to save him, and that should look like this. And what happens is, noticing that what's our idea,
mm-hmm.
and how attached are we? And what is actually happening when we feel that reality doesn't meet our wish? And that's also another attachment that is actually happening. Damn, this guy is not fulfilling my wish. I mean, I had that desire, and what happens now? And that's another attachment. There are two attachments there. The attachment of the idea of what is it to save someone, and our attachment to saving that person in that specific way. And that's also the difference maybe with serving. You know, it's just like you serve, and it's like,
yeah,
just continue serving, you know, and it's but if you want that the person you serve is actually do enjoy the food that you're actually serving, that's a whole other story, and we get into a whole other type of issues with ourselves and with the other person. Why don't you like the food I'm actually serving you? Well, sorry, you don't like it. I'm just serving. It's just like, that's all I can do, you know. That's what we can do. But then, you know, that's why I feel also like if I feel the frustration about, oh my God, that person is not, doesn't enjoy the, is not appreciating the meal, the wisdom, I'm actually, what I think is my wisdom, that I'm serving her, him, you know, and then I get frustrated, you know, and I'm getting attached to also my wisdom, my so-called wisdom, or my, what I see that, what I feel might be useful for that person. Well, you know, you don't know, maybe what you did is actually the most she could receive, or he's the most that he could receive, and that did him a lot of good, but maybe not to the extent that you hoped for.
Mm-hmm.
And that needs to be accepted also, you know.
Yeah, maybe also that you have you have to do a lot of work in yourself to live your life. Nobody else lives your life. You have your own responsibility, your own, you make your choices. You can't, and that's what he, I don't know. It's difficult to explain, but I have something else. A question: did you mean the mindfulness is like a tool to be in the moment? Can be a tool to be in the moment, to live in the moment.
Sorry, I didn't get that. I didn't understand that. Did I meet the monk?
Mindfulness in life helps you to be in the moment.
Yes.
So that's a tool to be in the moment.
Oh, a tool. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, like mindfulness practices, that all kinds of mindfulness practices to help you to be in the moment. Yeah. Be with your breath, be with your body, be with your thoughts, you know, noticing, paying attention.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I felt that there was something I wanted to add with what the last part of what you said about that. You know, yes, it's true that the person, we are responsible whether or not responsible for our own life and how we, whether or not we want to flourish and whether or not, you know, whatever we do. And if, you know, we might wish something for someone, but yeah, it is not meeting him where he is or where she is, mm-hmm. not to recognize that this is, for the moment, it's not the right timing for her or him to accept what is being offered.
Yes.
We can only acknowledge that, and if we don't, then we feel frustrated. We feel at ease. We feel that we haven't accomplished something. We have a sense of failure, and it's important to. I feel it's important to look into that too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, when we are off balance in a way, when we are getting out of that inner space of equanimity, I feel this is the moment where we feel, okay, something is happening in there. Something is happening. We fell back into the picking and choosing. And because of that, we are moving out from that space of equanimity, of oneness. Yeah, Chuan.
Good evening, everyone. through during much of what you said in the beginning, I kept thinking about these three aspects that Bernie Glassman that he talked about, particularly the second, bearing witness to the joys and sufferings of the world. And I don't know if this is correct or not, but it's what he called appropriate action bearing witness, I kept going back to that. Because if you are truly, I feel the experience when it's only afterwards that we can, it's not in the moment. It's usually this kind of thing that we think about afterwards. When there was a really true experience of bearing witness, I can see afterwards that there was no desire to have an answer or a question or a solution or helping in some kind of way. It's not often that it happens, but I think I can sense the difference when it does happen like that. I kept coming back to the somehow in all that you were saying, it kind of kept resonating, this bearing witness, truly bearing witness.
Yeah, I find it's another way to express the first task of embrace life, you know, to bear witness. But also in Bernie's framework, it's a roadmap. It's also the first aspect is not knowing. So we bear witness with this ground anchored into this not knowing, and that makes the whole difference, because if we bear witness but we bear witness with our opinions and conceptions and discrimination and all that, we it's much more difficult to actually embrace life as a whole, right? We have partial views.
Just a very quick question. I didn't understand Stephen Batchelor's formulation, embrace life. It corresponds to what exactly? Now
I'm corresponds to the first noble truth.
Okay.
The first noble truth being life is suffering. And instead of talking about life is suffering, the problem with life is suffering, well, life is dukkha, is dukkha is actually, it's not suffering really. I mean, it's just, in the sutras it's being described as in a whole series of events that happens that also includes joyful events. So it's like life is c'est la vie, as we say in French, it's a huge package, you know. That's life, it's wanting, getting what you don't want. It's also getting what you want. It's all kinds of things. It's joyful events and all that. And so, he transformed that into this task to embrace life. Yeah. And the second noble truth is about the origin of suffering, it's letting go of reactivity, and so there's a whole framework that corresponds. The Buddha never talks about truth. There are no truth, and so certainly not truth that kind of describes the world. So it's not the way that he's thinking goes around. All right, we should stop here. It's time. Well, thank you so much for listening and sharing and responding. Thank you. Thank you.